Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Afternoon. Thank you for joining me, Justin Brierley. I'm with you through till 4 o'clock this Saturday afternoon. And a big thank you to Megan for I Choose. And don't forget, Dave and B here with Hip Rock UK between 4 and 6 this afternoon. Right now, it's time to do our discussion with Christians and non-Christians here in the studio. You're unbelievable. That's right, and today we're talking about whether we can trust the Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, they're what Christians rely on to know about the life, history, story and character of Jesus. But Norman Hansen, our atheist today, says we just can't rely on them. They're just a lot of myths put together long after the events that they're actually talking about. We're going to hear from him, also from Andy Bannister from the London School of Theology. Andy says we've got all the evidence we need to be able to trust in the Gospels. That's the programme today here on Unbelievable. And I'll be telling you how you can get in touch with us a little bit later on the programme. Now, before we get to our guest this afternoon, some response to the last couple of weeks of programmes. Firstly, a couple of weeks ago, we had Beverly Alfred, a Reiki healer, on with Sally Coleman, and they were talking about Christianity and the New Age and that sort of thing. This came in from Kevin in Shepherd's Bush. You say, Kevin, we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. I was disappointed that Sally did not more fully engage Beverly's alternative spirituality. Neither Sally nor Beverly discussed the issue of personal sin, for this is truly the sign of our age when Christians and non-Christians alike don't want to talk about sin or hell. You say Jesus was deadly serious when he spoke about the reality of hell and the real danger of eternal damnation. If there is no sin or hell, then Jesus died on Calvary for nothing. Beverly chose to focus completely on God's infinite love and mercy and that everyone's going to heaven, but chose to forget about God's infinite justice. Thank you very much for your email, Kevin. Funny you should mention the issue of hell and damnation and that sort of thing. That's coming up next week on this programme as we discuss Christian universalism. I'll give a bit more detail a bit later on in the programme about that topic next week. First, though, before we meet our guest for this week, as I say, wanted to do some reflection on last week's programme on Sharia law. If you didn't manage to listen to it, do go to our webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can listen back to the programme there. I had with me Beth Grove and Catherine Heseltine. They were talking about the implications of Sharia and whether it could ever be instituted in some way here in the UK officially. I've got some more of your emails, but let's listen to some of your reactions. And yes, certainly a lot of people wanted to respond to Catherine, our Muslim guest on the programme last week, and her particular way of seeing Sharia.
Hi, my name is Tonya Adeyi. I believe Catherine, the Muslim lady on the show, does not really know 100% what she's talking about. Sharia law, I would like to say, is evil and it should not be allowed in United Kingdom. I know of a case of a lady who got pregnant, had a baby out of wedlock. This was in Nigeria. She was going to be stoned to death under Sharia law. You know, what does she say about that? I think she really does not know what she's talking about.
Catherine Hazeltine comes across as being a very, very, very confused Muslim woman. She's got herself into this Muslim thing and she doesn't know what she has embraced. What she's done is just taken some aspects of Muslim which she likes and she has left the ones which she does not want. That does not represent a 100% Muslim woman. I grew up in a Muslim home and I know what is Muslim at all. You cannot just take some aspects and leave some out, and you cannot westernize, in inverted commas, any aspects of the Sharia law. You cannot westernize it. It's laid out by the Arabs and that's it. I think you need to go to the Muslim world, Arab world, live in a Muslim home, get married to an Arab guy, and then you will, or a Muslim man in an Arab world, and then you'll know what is Muslim. You certainly will find out very quickly. From my view, the Christian religion is far more embracing and favorable for women.
Hello, my name is Zora, and as you can tell from my name, I come from a Muslim background. She's talking rubbish nonsense on inheritance. She's not an Islamic scholar, so she doesn't know a thing. I grew up in an Islamic home, and inheritance do say that the man gets 2/3 and the sister only gets 1/3, and in fact, I'm fighting for my inheritance. I've been fighting for my inheritance on the basis that I must get equal rights to it. And they're going, no, and I'm going, yes. And so that's when the law of the country comes in, and I will get my equal share. So I'm afraid the Sharia law is too much anti-woman, and women will not accept it at all. In fact, a lot of Muslims, women who grew up in a Muslim home, don't want Sharia law at all because it's all against them. They rather have the British law or the law of a Commonwealth country where...
Well, thank you very much for those messages. A couple more on the way in just a moment. But first of all, some emails. Chelvi says, I found the discussion on Sharia law a bit unbalanced. There were not many to speak out the truth in defence of the old-fashioned law. I can't understand why there were no British Muslims to debate on this, Asians who have grown up in the UK. I know that many of them do not want Sharia in the UK and are concerned there's no publicity given to the wrongdoing of families who get away with honour killings and forced marriages, etc. And as Mr. Hack did remind us very correctly, it was the Archbishop who mentioned that this type of law should exist, not the Muslims themselves. Sorry, I haven't got time to read out all of your email, Chelvi. Reginald says, before we had the Christian Bible that we have today, and before the time of the coming of Islam in the 7th century, the Bible was not completed as the official Christian canon of Orthodox belief, which we have today. And the early Christians were not known as the people of the book, but as people of Jesus Christ, Christians, who is the unique Son of God. You could then go on to say, Reginald, that Muhammad called Christians and Jews the people of the book in order to demote and lessen the person and uniqueness of Jesus as the only unique Son of God and all that that entails. In Muhammad's mind, Jesus was merely a human prophet. This was, however, a heretical belief which was could be compared to the heresy known as Arianism, which arose and was rejected by the Church Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. Thank you very much for your thoughts on that as well. If you want to, as I say, listen back to that programme on Sharia, the webpage premier.org.uk/unbelievable is the place to go. And there's a whole bag of past programmes that you can listen to there as well. Let's get a couple more of your responses to that programme on Sharia of last week.
I'd like to leave some about two, three questions for Catherine. She spoke of high moral standards. Is she aware that the Quran is actually taken out of the Old Testament or the Torah? And most of the words that were taken out of the Old Testament have been changed for the purpose of creating Islam. And is she also aware that those prophets that she says are prophets of Islam were all Jewish men, and they spoke of prophecies that pointed to the coming of Jesus Christ. And then thirdly, does it mean that all Islamic women are prostitutes? Because the Jewish custom then was that prostitutes had to cover up, because that's what Islam seems to have made as a way of dressing for women today. So, you know, it's very sad that she peeped into the Word of God and into the truth and then decided to turn her back. And lastly, Revelation speaks of judgment, the false prophets, and the Antichrist, because that's the agenda of the world today. Is she aware of all those things? Thank you so much, Justin.
The Muslim business people that I know try to, well, they do employ women for much less pay than they pay the men. In one shop, I know the men, male staff are paid £6 an hour, whereas the women, Muslim women, are paid £3.25. I do intend to get the Equal Opportunities Commission involved, and as well as the job centre, because he's clearly breaking the law. I wondered if it was a police matter, but if this is what Sharia law means, then forget it. And I think a lot of Muslims are just in cloud cuckoo land if they think that Sharia law is the right law. If it wasn't for the British Christian laws, then there would be no justice in the world, let alone this country. But when we colonised other parts of the world, we took our laws with us. But to bring Sharia law to this country would certainly not be doing anyone a favour. I've seen so many Muslim women be battered. Muslim women who are battered seem to have no option but to go to places provided by Christian laws. One of my friend's husbands accused her of messing around with a male colleague simply because the clip on her bra strap dug into her skin. He's a microbiologist, he has common sense and intelligence, but he makes her life hell because of similar silly incidents like that, where his brain is overactive. In many cases, women with husbands like this get absolutely mauled almost to death. How would Sharia law help them? It would not.
Well, thank you very much for all your responses. And as I say, I'll be giving out the response if you want to get in touch with us about the programme this week. We're talking today about whether we can trust the Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, that's how we know about the story of Jesus. Norman Hansen is a former Christian. He's now an atheist. Part of the reason for him giving up his faith was because of what he says are the fact that he just, in the end, couldn't believe that the Gospels were really true. Andy Bannister is our Christian. He'll be telling us why he believes they can be trusted. Do hope you can stay with me.
Connecting with culture.
It's all very well to hear that you can make a difference where you are, as the LICC publicly states, but who really believes it? Sometimes it seems that we simply don't have the chance. Aside from keeping you cool admirably when the photocopier packs up just at the wrong moment, or not swearing at your children when they poke you in the eye, or confessing at the checkout when they've given you too much change, when do we ever truly get to make our mark on society? Patience, argues the Emeritus Professor of Psychology at Stanford University, Philip Zimbardo, in an intriguing article in last week's Guardian. He suggests that just as people conform, yield, and succumb to the negative power of many social situations, there are always some who refuse and resist. That, if you like, is their, and hopefully our, orientation, primed and ready to walk a different path when called to. While some situations spark a hostile imagination in people, they simultaneously provoke the heroic imagination of the few. We must teach people to think of themselves as heroes in waiting, he argues, ready to take heroic action in a particular situation that may only occur once in their lifetime. In the meantime, it's worth taking heart from the psychologist Oliver James, who believes that while 90% of the English-speaking middle classes are afflicted by affluenza, his term for the mental and emotional dis-ease which results from our relentless materialism, 1 in 10 resist and have a disproportionately positive influence on the rest. In a recent interview for Church Times, he said that he was startled to find that the healthy 1 in 10 had either enjoyed very good childhoods, which is extremely rare, or experienced an awakening, often through trauma, which was spiritual in nature. Christians, as well as those who are spiritual and ethical, he suggests, quietly infect everybody else. It only takes a few people, who embody by the way they live their lives, good way to be, to push others back. Whether or not we feel, as followers of Christ, that we are making a difference, according to Dr. James, we almost certainly will be. Not always through what we achieve, but simply through who we are. Salt of the earth, lights of the world, a smattering of ordinary people who can awaken to their new identity as heroes in waiting.
That was Connecting with Culture, brought to you by the London Institute of Contemporary Christianity. Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And thanks once again for being with me this Saturday afternoon. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the studio our two guests for our discussion today. Both have been on the programme before. In fact, both have sort of spoken to each other on the programme before, but not face to face. I think the last occasion our two guests were together, one was on the phone and one was in the studio. They're both with me in the studio today, however. They are Norman Hansen. He's a computer programmer by profession, but he's got a very interesting story, which we'll hear about shortly. And he's here to talk about why he believes we can't trust the Gospels, why we can't trust what we have in the New Testament as far as its reliability, authenticity, and all that sort of thing. Andy Bannister is also with us, representing a Christian viewpoint on this. Andy, from the London School of Theology, does lots of very clever things there, and I'm sure he'll enlighten us a bit about that as well as we go. But welcome, gentlemen, both, for being with us. Norman, let's turn to you first of all. It was some time back that you last joined us, but tell us a bit about yourself for those who perhaps can't stretch their minds back all that far.
Right, yes, I think it's quite a while from what you were saying earlier, about 18 months. But yes, I became a Christian at university. I was at the University of Manchester studying physics at the time. In 1972, I professed faith in Jesus Christ. Continued as a Christian for about 30 years after that. I was involved part-time in Christian work with a missionary organization. At the end of the 90s was considering very seriously going out to Albania as a missionary with my family. And it was only the events that occurred when their economy collapsed that prevented us going any further with that at the time. In 1995, a crisis came, crisis isn't quite the right word, but a sort of confrontation with creationism came. And I'd kind of put the issue of creationism to the back of my mind until then, and had been quite happy to be a Christian who believed in sort of theistic evolution and so on, and just thought that that would be compatible with my faith. But it was as my church became more involved with creationism, I realized that I needed to think it through, and realized that if you were going to take the Bible seriously, you had to decide whether you believed in creationism or whether you believed in the scientific facts. And it was on the basis of that, really, that over a period of years, so the 30 years ended in 2002, I came to the conclusion that I could no longer be a Christian.
It's a major change because your life was very much centered in your faith.
Yep.
And your involvement in your church, and you were involved in a Christian organization. That was where your employment was, and so this was a huge change for you. Obviously, that was on a more scientific side that caused this confrontation, this crisis of faith.
Sure.
Today, we're talking about something a little bit different, a sort of historical, literary kind of analysis of the Bible and whether it's true or not. Was that coming along at the same time to cause problems to your faith?
Or well, yes, it was. One of the issues was I was always being told to sort of consider Jesus and look at Jesus, and the rest of it would fall in around that, and I would be able to make some sort of sense around that. But the more I looked at Jesus, the more I had problems with Jesus as well. And it's the issue of what are the Gospels actually saying? How do you validate the stories in the Gospels with any historical truth, in a sense? And that's where it really started to unravel.
So for you, the whole thing sort of fell apart, and ultimately you now count yourself as, well, an atheist, would that be fair to say?
Yes, I would say I was an atheist, and a strong atheist, in the sense that I don't believe there is a God.
Mm.
Or rather, I believe there is no God, rather.
Mm.
It's that there are two sorts of atheists, if you like. There are those who don't believe in gods, but are, you know, possibly like Richard Dawkins, sort of on a scale where if evidence was produced, they would say, well, yes, okay.
Right.
I would probably say if you could produce real evidence, yes, I would believe. But I don't think you can produce that evidence because I think the concept of God, at least the way that God is put forward in the Christian sense of pre-existent without any sort of his own creation, without any sort of component parts, as it were, is just a logical impossibility.
Right.
So,
well, that's an interesting subject for another program, perhaps, but we probably won't have time to venture into that particular area. But we're going to look at that, one of those main things that really, for you, was part of your journey out of faith, if you like, this idea of whether we can trust the Gospels, whether what we have as a record of Jesus's life and ministry is authentic, is trustworthy. And obviously you're here to say what you believe about that and why you don't believe that is the case. To represent why they believe the Gospel is to be trusted, why we can have faith in what we have received in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, we've got Andy Bannister from the London School of Theology. Thank you for being with us, Andy.
Good to be here, Justin.
It's great to have you with me, Andy. I don't know how often this sort of thing comes up for you, Andy, but is this an area that you've sort of spent some time looking into and researching?
It's going to be an interesting discussion, actually, because it's an area I've done some research into, but it's not my own particular area. Excuse me. My own background is philosophy and comparative religion. So Islam is my area of expertise. That's what I teach on at LST as a visiting lecturer. And then I'm a philosopher by training as well. So I was itching at some of the comments Norm was making earlier and thinking there are some fascinating discussions we could have on another show. But like any Christian, any thinking Christian, you have to engage with these issues. You can't escape them. There are good questions, and I'm sure Norman will raise some good questions. I hope I'll have some good answers and we'll have an interesting discussion. You can't escape, I think, the question about, you know, what are the Gospels trying to say? Can we trust them? How do we know they're true? These kind of questions are ones that Christians need to grapple with and need to engage with and be confident in.
You've studied theology, obviously, a lot, but has it ever kind of given you pause to think, is this really true? Have you ever kind of come up against a kind of crisis of faith sort of moment?
My biggest crisis of faith moment, ironically, I mean, I had one as well, but that came really through the studying Islam. That back in the late 1990s, when I first started getting involved in sharing my faith with Muslims, I found my Muslim friends asking me questions about the Bible that I couldn't answer. And Muslims have a lot of problem with the Bible. Many Muslims will claim the Bible has been corrupted because it contradicts the Quran. And obviously, from a Muslim point of view, if it contradicts the Quran, it can't be true.
Mm.
And some of the questions I found my Muslim friends asking me were the ones I'd never encountered as a Christian. This was before I studied theology. And so what that did was drive me to research, was to drive me to read and to study, to discover. Actually, I didn't consider myself an academic at that time. I was a youth worker by background.
Oh, right.
And that led to a discovery of a love of history, a love of theology, and that led me eventually to going to London Bible College, as we were then, and sort of studying these things. So in a sense, the crisis of faith was still the same.
Right.
It needed that, I think, to get me off sort of just trotting along, happy with the same old thing. But it went a slightly different direction to Norman's.
I suppose one thing, a word that might sum up perhaps what we're doing here is apologetics, apologetics being the defence of Christianity, the defence of the Bible, etc. And so, in a sense, you, Norman, are apologetic against the Bible, and you, Andy, are an apologetic for the Bible.
Yeah, that would be a fair comment, I think.
I mean, does a lot of this is kind of is this about point scoring? Is it about, you know, well, I've got this source, but I've got this source? I mean, how much of this actually kind of to you, Andy, kind of really will make a difference for the layperson on the ground? You know, how important is it for Christians to kind of really have a good grasp of this sort of, quite at the end of the day, sort of high level sort of stuff?
I think I'd approach the answering that in two ways. From the point of view of the average Christian, if there is such a thing in this day and age, I think it is important to, as Peter puts it in his first epistle, you know, it's important to have a reason for the hope that we profess, to be confident in what we believe. So I think that's important for Christians, and there is a degree to which you can do that, I think, without delving into, you know, the intricacies of first century politics and great, you know, theological textbooks that would bend the average shelf nicely in two. But I also think it's useful because for some non-Christians, this is a question. I have to say it's not the most common question I come up against. Neither actually is the science one. The most common question I encounter with my non-Christian friends are things like, why does God allow suffering? You know, something's gone wrong in my life. My mother's just died of cancer. How can God possibly have allowed that? That tends to be the bigger question. But some non-Christians do raise this question. And I think when you begin investigating questions about God and is God real? Who is Jesus? The kind of questions that you have to grapple with as if you're coming to faith, then you will hit this question of the Bible and particularly the Gospels at some point.
Well, we're going to have a fascinating discussion this afternoon with our guest, Norman Hansen, who is an atheist. And we've just heard a fascinating story of how he was a fully, as it were, signed up Christian, evangelical Christian. But a number of things, including the concerns he had about the truth of the Bible, have led him to deconvert and to put his those days behind him. Now he's an atheist. He's going to be talking with Andy Bannister of the London School of Theology, there, my guest here, as we talk about the historicity of the Gospels. That's a bit of a technical word, but essentially we're talking about, you know, can we trust them? Do they give an accurate record of what they claim to do and to show? It's the kind of thing that we need to investigate. And as Andy said in that letter from Peter, it's what he says we need to do. Be sure of the hope that we have and be able to give a good reason for it. So if you're listening and you'd like to get in touch during the course of the programme, give your reflections, give your comments, maybe ask a question, you're welcome to do that and leave me a voicemail message. I'll happily play it out next week and pass it on to our guests. The voicemail number 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. If you'd like to email the show, that's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll be continuing.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $10,000 matching grant that will double your gift today. And right now, that's an incredible blessing as we're needing $65,000 before the end of the financial year on June 30th. This show depends on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to meet this $65,000 need, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you. I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $10,000 matching grant that will double your gift today. And right now, that's an incredible blessing as we're needing $65,000 before the end of the financial year on June 30th. This show depends on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to meet this $65,000 need, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you.
Our discussion in just a moment here on the show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So Christians really take for granted the stories of Jesus and the life account in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. It really is the bedrock of our beliefs about Jesus and the person he was and the things he claimed to do and be. But many atheists are saying we can't trust the Gospels as we have received them. Things have changed over time. They weren't authored by the people who claim to have authored them. They have been changed. In a sense, the stories in the first place were made up. They were very obvious theological reasons for why people would have said the things that were said about Jesus. We're going to be looking at some of these claims, and Norman Hansen, our atheist on the programme this afternoon, is going to be explaining why he believes that we can't trust the Gospels and what they have to say about Jesus. But defending the Gospels this afternoon, Andy Bannister of the London School of Theology, who says we've got all the evidence we need, really, to have a firm faith in the Gospels and their truth. The historicity of the Gospels is the technical way of putting it. Hope you can listen in for the coming hour or so as we debate this particular issue for the rest of the programme here on Unbelievable. Well, there's all kinds of areas we could look at here, gentlemen, and so maybe we'll sort of launch straight in to some of what we're talking about. I mean, maybe the first thing to make clear is that maybe a lot of people have a kind of almost Sunday school idea of the Bible, that it's sort of a book which just kind of was written by God and it just kind of arrived all of a piece and, you know, That's the way it is. That's kind of how I grew up. Obviously, later on, I learned that, in fact, there are lots of different writers of the Bible, and these were, certainly in the New Testament, different letters that were written by different people in different contexts at different times. And that at some point, you know, these were formalised into what we now know as the New Testament. I mean, that much, you know, most people who are Christians kind of get to understand, you know, by a certain point in their life. But Norman, your contention is that we can't trust that, in particular, the Gospels were actually written about, or that the facts recorded there are actually historically true, that what the Gospel writers say happened to Jesus and the things he did actually did happen in that way. Now, in the first place, why would they have made up this sort of stuff? Is there an obvious reason why this stuff would have been fabricated or made up?
I can't sort of be 100% certain of motives behind why anybody does anything, but clearly it was coming out of a situation with the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the Jewish state meant there was a lot going on, and it clearly met a need for the believers at the time. But my problem with the Gospels as historical documents is the miracles really, because they present as a series of effectively tall tales. Now, that might be sort of shocking in the sense that, you know, I'm lumping it in with, say, Baron Munchausen or something, but because we've culturally got an idea that this is sort of historically true, even people who don't really believe have kind of got there's a sort of cultural background in the Bible. It's viewed more as a history book than it possibly should be.
Whereas most people, if they came across stories like the feeding of the 5,000 in something that claimed to be historical, would say, yeah, oh, well, they must have been a legend or something.
Yes, or the raising of the widow's son would be another example. So you have, the hero does something miraculous, but usually you would think, yes, this is just being extrapolated from something, or just added. I mean, a good example would be somebody like Francis Xavier, who was a Catholic missionary to India and China, and legends about him and his linguistic prowess were around within a couple of decades afterwards, and they grew to the point where once when he was sainted or canonized, he was able to speak and everybody could hear in their own language, sort of the Pentecostal sort of gift of tongues. And yet when we've got his letters and when people look at those, you can see that he really struggled with the language. He didn't get the grasp of any of the languages, really, and he relied on people to translate and bodge together what he was trying to communicate.
So you're suggesting that in the same way that his sort of abilities were sort of exaggerated by his followers, who obviously esteemed him greatly, etc. A similar thing would have happened with the account of Jesus, and so what we have is vastly different to probably what actually happened in reality.
Yes, I mean, even if it did really happen in reality, or it could be that Jesus is just an amalgam of various people who, there were various stories about. And
So it's possible even that there wasn't a single character that they're talking about
here.
I
certainly would take that view, that you can't necessarily tie it down to a single historical character, because there's just so little evidence. There's, in some ways, that the evidence for Jesus is not much better than the evidence for Sherlock Holmes, in that there's a plausible story behind it, and you can tie Sherlock Holmes in with the Victorian times and, his trip to Norbury to investigate this and, off to Docklands and so on. But it's... But he wasn't real.
Well, let's allow Andy to answer, because there's two things there. The problem of the miracles, but also whether Jesus was sort of an amalgam of different people.
Let's take those in reverse order. I think the first thing I'd want to say, without committing the fallacy of sort of appealing to scholarly authority, no serious historical scholar working in the first century of either atheist or Christian stripe would claim that Jesus never existed. And I don't think that's quite what Norman's saying, but that particular one or two sort of post-Enlightenment sort of writers have tried to suggest that, and the idea has been dead and buried. If you look at even the most sceptical writers, someone like John Crossan, for example, who's a radical New Testament critic, would have no truck with the idea that there was no historical Jesus, because the evidence is good and is solid, and I think we'll come to this later. The Sherlock Holmes analogy, I think that's a really interesting one to deal with, actually, because, again, this raises a fascinating question to go, if one would want to compare Jesus to Sherlock Holmes, you'd want to compare like with like and say, well, let's look for a major radical sociological new movement in Victorian times, which defined their entire identity around Sherlock Holmes, which completely rewrote Victorian values from top to bottom, that completely transformed the world around them and reacted in many ways in quite countercultural ways, and left a lasting movement that's grown until the present day? Answer, there isn't. If you take Jesus out of the first century, you end up with, as one non-Christian scholar put it, you end up with a Jesus-shaped hole. You have to somehow explain the rise of the early church in its Jewish context. And in fact, the only way that you can really remove the Jesus of history is you have to completely ignore as well the Judaism that was there as the background belief of the first Christians, because Christianity arose in a Jewish background and the first Christians were Jewish. So we may come to some of these issues later. Can I take the miracle?
Go ahead.
As well? Let's press on and look at miracles. Miracles raises a fascinating question. And there's a whole range of issues here. I think the first thing I'd want to say is, aside from the question of whether miracles can or did not happen, if we rule out of court any ancient historical source because of the presence of miracles, we would actually know next to nothing about the ancient world. I mean, let's take the Roman Empire, for example. Vast amounts of material that we have on the Roman emperors ascribes miracles to them. So if you look at, say, Vespasian, you look at the miracles that are ascribed to him, or to Julius Caesar himself, because it was considered that the Roman emperor was divine, therefore of course he would do miracles, etc., etc., etc. If we take the presence of miracles in some of the ancient writings as signs they're not historical, we can lose Pliny, we can lose Suetonius, we can lose Tacitus, and so on and so forth. So simply because miracles are in a document doesn't mean we can throw the document out per se, which leads us on to a second question, I guess, which is the fundamental assumptions that we bring to the kind of historical question. And the question of whether miracles can or cannot happen is actually not a question that history equips us to answer. That's not a historical question. It's actually a philosophical and theological question. And I would sort of suggest to Norman, and I'm sure he'd probably agree to some extent, that actually it's his atheism and the fact that for him God doesn't exist, and of course miracles are out of the question. There is no supernatural, there is only naturalism.
But I suppose, Norman, you might come back here with, well, if other historians of the time were recording miracles alongside their sort of factual stuff, and we presumably don't believe that the emperors really did do these miracles, then surely that kind of lends weight to your argument that it would have been a natural thing for these writers to have included miracles, even though they didn't actually happen? I mean...
There are two points to that. One is that it would be natural, but that doesn't make the miracles true, or And while I wouldn't throw the Gospels out as documents from you know an ancient time, it doesn't then make them true either. You know that people generally believed in miracles. We don't believe that Augustus was a virgin, the result of a virgin birth, or you know. And there are a lot of parallels between, say, Augustus and Jesus, and claims about their sort of early lives, like the wise men turning up to greet them at their birth. Some of these things are sort of mythical forms that are kind of plugged in because you have to have that to be valid as a messiah. If you like,
so you think,
or a god emperor, or whatever.
Whoever was writing down the history of Jesus was just kind of throwing this stuff in because they had to kind of do that to follow the kind of form of the time.
I think Matthew's gospel is a very good example of that, where he just throws in prophecies and ties them back to or ties them into Jesus, rather in the same way that people would say that. The Twin Towers disaster was prophesied by
Nostradamus.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah, I heard of that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's sometimes very very hard to say what the motivation is behind somebody doing any particular thing, whatever it is. You know, and I think in Matthew's case, I'm sure that he probably thought that if there was a Jesus, and if his account, because he includes a lot of Mark, and he might want to disagree with that. He might want to say that Mark is derived from Matthew, but that he'd added on, well, Jesus must have done this because, you know, he saw in Isaiah that, you know, there was the prophecy about this, that, and the other, and so on.
Right.
You know, it's
well, Andy. I mean, what do you? I mean, it might be, you know, theologically true to say that a gospel writer has a kind of a motive, because, for instance, you know, it's well known that the Gospel of John is a very different kind of gospel to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because it appears that John's trying to put some very theological concepts across a lot of the time. Now, does that mean that we don't trust what they've written because it's not sort of, you know, if they've got these agendas to push? I don't know.
I certainly don't think I would want to play off the idea of a gospel writer having an agenda versus the question of whether we can trust them. In a sense, that's a category mistake. I think history is always written with an agenda. You always write history for a reason, and I would have no problem, with the idea that the gospel writers are writing to put forward a particular presentation of Jesus. Of course they are. They're writing within the community of faith. Of course they are. That's not a problem. Having this discussion this morning, I'm coming to this as a Christian. Norman is coming as an atheist. So we always bring, you know, our baggage and our worldview with us when we write, when we communicate. That's not a problem at all whatsoever, as far as I understand it. I think the more interesting argument is to say that sometimes where things get a little bit slippery and where mistakes are made is then to suggest that, you know, Matthew's idea of Jesus was just his idea based on some odd things he'd heard. Again, scholars are pretty certain now, there's very good evidence for the way the early church movement was set up, that actually all of the gospel writers were writing for a wide audience. The idea that Matthew was writing just for himself, or even just for his little church, is now done and dusted in historical studies. It's recognised that very quickly the early church got itself set up and going. Documents were widely circulated. So Matthew's gospel, Mark, Luke, John, and so forth, were writing, recognising that their gospels, their works, were going to be read by a very wide audience. We see the same in the writings of Paul, actually, and it's interesting, we won't have time to go into Paul's writings this morning, but Paul's writings represent some of the earliest strata of New Testament materials. And Paul can assume, for example, when he writes to the Roman church, a church he's never visited, he can assume vast range of belief, standard Orthodox Christian beliefs, that he can assume that the Roman Christians will have just 10 to 15 years after the events of the crucifixion and the resurrection. Paul can assume that the Christian diaspora, the Christians spread out across the ancient world, share a similar set of beliefs, a similar set of ideas, and a context in which he can write into. And the gospel writers are doing the same. It's not that, you know, you can't, so in a sense, trying to play off Matthew's theology versus John's theology is a mistake, because these documents were, from the first their first stages, read and held and believed alongside one another.
I mean, going back to a point that Norman made about whether Matthew was sort of copying a lot from Mark, This raises the whole question of who wrote down first the stuff and how much did they kind of take from each other. Are these four completely separate accounts? Are these four accounts which have borrowed a lot from each other? I mean, where do you see it, and is this a problem?
Let me try and give a very simple answer to what is a complex subject. Scholars would generally say, and the moment one says that, you know your the phones are going to start ringing with people who can cite contrary examples, that the earliest gospel of the four that we have is Mark. Most scholars would accept, I'd have no problem with the idea, that Mark wrote first, pretty early. There are question marks over exactly how early, somewhere probably in the early 50s, possibly as late as the mid-60s. But most scholarship now, although there are exceptions, would come to the position of saying that Mark is before the fall of Jerusalem, for example.
So this would be 20 to 30 years after the death
Absolutely.
Of Christ.
Absolutely. Then what you have is sometime shortly after that, you have Matthew and Luke writing, and both Matthew and Luke draw upon Mark in places. So there are places in Matthew, Mark and Luke, what are known as the Synoptic Gospels, when you can line up passages from them, the stories from them alongside one another, and you can see where Matthew and Luke have quite clearly drawn heavily upon Mark, for example. And then John writes last. John is generally accepted as being the last of the four Gospels.
Right.
And again, the dating is questioned. Possibly sort of mid-70s to late 80s, somewhere in that range, depending
on... And is it important to you that these weren't written down 100 years after the death of Christ, sort of thing?
Exactly. It's important for... The dating is interesting for two reasons. Firstly, I mean, without going too much into my own sort of other area of expertise, my own PhD is in oral tradition and the Quran, so I spent an awful lot of time researching oral tradition, oral narratives, oral history, and how that works. So for myth to develop, you actually need a vast amount of time. So we haven't got the time span between...
Norman obviously wants to reply on that. We may
come back to that.
Yeah.
You actually need a vast... You do need a longer period of time for things to evolve. And we could probably argue this classically if you want to and bore our audience to death. But more importantly, we'll come back to the discussion and have a ding-dong about that one. But at the other end of the scale... We're not talking documents written 100 to 300 years after the death of the events, which would be a problem. And one of the things that is commonly said in apologetics, and it's slightly simplistic, but actually there's a lot of truth in it, is the Gospels stand up very well when you compare the time gap between them and the events that they relate with the other side of the equation. I mean, if we look at someone like sort of Homer, for example, on the Greek classical side of things, and the time gap between when he was supposed to have written the Iliad and the Odyssey, and our first copies not only of his writings, but of biographical material about him, you're talking a gap of 500, 600, 700 years. So the Gospels were written easily within the lifespan of the first eyewitnesses, certainly within the lifespan of the next generation. And in fact, if you read the writings of the early Christians who are writing immediately after the second generation of Christians, people like Papias and those kind of guys, they were in touch with the eyewitnesses. They are able to cite eyewitness sources for vast amounts of the Gospels.
Well, I can tell Norman's itching to have a response to that. But before we do that, let me just reiterate the number and the email address if you want to get in touch. Perhaps you've got a question or a comment to put to our guests. I can certainly forward your comments onto them, and I'll read them out or play them out on next week's programme. 08456 52 52 52. Select option 5 if you'd like to leave me a voicemail message. And you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So Andy's outlined why he believes we've got a good reason to trust the Gospels in terms of just how closely they were written to the events they're talking about. And yes, happy to admit that the Gospel writers did, you know, borrow from each other, you know, in places. What then for you is the major problem? You sort of snorted slightly when Andy said there was there wasn't enough time for myth to develop.
The time for myth. Well, I've already mentioned Francis Xavier, who was in that sort of time scale, mythologized, you know, and then became a saint. And I think, a lot of Catholic saints have the same sort of process. They're, you know, within a few years, the myths have appeared, and the myth is much more powerful than the reality. So, you come along, people came along and sort of said to the, Xavier's converts, you know, well, he wasn't quite like this, and oh, no, he was. The same with... things like, you know, the appearance at Fatima and things like that. There's a sort of myth built up out of a what was probably a very small incident, you know, where people were dazzled by goodness knows what, but they then sort of believe that they've seen the sun fall to earth, and then it grows. So I think Andy's taking the William Craig idea, which is to sort of quote some academic who said, oh, you know, you couldn't mythologize somebody in that sort of time. But I don't think that's actually borne out by the facts. But the other thing is that the Gospels, I think, were written with this mythologizing in them. They were expected to be that. And some of the other not Messiah figures, but people who had followings, like the Egyptian, whose, you know, actual name we don't know, said he was going to part the waters of the Jordan and so on. And they made various claims, which, you know, you can see that followers would take that as being fulfilled in the same way that, you know, Andy was saying, I had to compare like with like, say, you know, Sherlock Holmes isn't quite like Jesus. I would agree with that. But if you were to take a movement like the Mormons or the Jehovah's Witnesses, where they're not sort of talking about individuals changing the world, but they have sprung up on a sort of fictional extrapolation of a sort of semi-Christian basis.
Mm. So you're saying movements happen on false bases.
The Jehovah's Witnesses are a perfect example where they've rationalized the failure of the second coming of Christ into various sort of events where, you know, first it was, well, you know, he had come, but it was only a spiritual coming, and then, you know, they've kind of toned it down, but the followers, you know, this is where the myth comes from. You know, the followers kind of can't.
And you said earlier that it would almost be expected for the writers to have mythologized the stuff. Are you saying that it was sort of,
given the subject it is, given that they're presenting a Messiah who is God's anointed, I think they would be expecting miracles, and would be starting to put miracles in as just a sort of to validate that he was real. So
so they want to validate he's real, even
yes.
though they know he's not real, because they know that they're adding the miracles
see it.
In.
I don't think they see it that way.
Right.
I think they're pious extrapolations from what they expect.
I mean,
to
the layperson, they may think, well, why would someone write down Jesus did X, Y, Z, fully knowing he didn't do X, Y, Z, because I'm just making it up? It doesn't seem to make sense.
No, I think they were on one, in some cases possibly looking at their Old Testament and filling in that this is what was prophesied, therefore it happened. So it's a sort of retrofitting.
Right.
What they've interpreted as a prophecy into what would have happened in Jesus' life.
Quick response to that, Andy, and we'll have to go to our break shortly. But what about this idea that they were just putting stuff in, because that was what was expected of them?
The very quick response, before we go into the break, we'd say that simply that just does not work for Jesus. Particularly, I'm very excited that Norman mentioned the word Messiah, because this is such a key one. Because to go, there was no Jewish expectation that the Messiah would be arrested and killed by his enemies and by the conquering powers, i.e. Rome, and then would rise from the dead 3 days later. That is a complete novum, a new idea when it comes to early Christianity. It's a mutation, scholars have often termed it in Judaism. There is no equivalent. What's interesting is to compare what happens with Jesus and his followers with what happens with other messianic candidates. One of my favourite ones, if you take someone like Simon, who was the leader of the rebels that the Romans are fighting against in 66 to 70, when Jerusalem falls in 70, he is dragged off by Titus, the leader of the Roman armies, to Rome and executed in public, to sort of great public acclaim by the Romans. What happens to his followers? They don't start a cult saying that, oh, actually, although Simon was killed by the Romans, he's really the Messiah, he's really God's anointed who's going to lead us to victory over our enemies and see the restoration of Israel to the place that Israel should be. No, he's a failure. Basically, and what do you do as a Jewish first century group if you back the wrong candidate? Normally you go into hiding, you pick another one, or another messianic candidate, you pick another leader, or at the very best, you might possibly suggest that he'd somehow been glorified in heaven alongside God. There was language for speaking about that. You certainly didn't say he'd risen from the dead, because in Jewish thinking, the general rising from the dead was what happened at the end of time when God wraps up the whole of history. So there's a major, major problem with actually comparing what happens with the Jesus movement and the direction they go with anything else, because there is no comparison. There is a historical uniqueness there, which is why this discussion is so much fun.
We'll be having more fun in the next section of the programme and allowing Norman to come back and looking at other aspects of why people might, you know, have a problem with the truth of the Gospels. What about contradictions between them? You know, could they have changed over time as well, as you know, from how they were first written down, etc. And at the end of the day, wouldn't God have given us, I suppose, this is a key question, a totally watertight, unquestionable document if this is the way we're supposed to learn about eternal truth? These are the kind of questions I want to find out about on the programme today, and we're going to continue to do that as we continue the discussion on the truth of the Gospels with our guests, Norman Hanson, he's an atheist, with us talking about why he doesn't believe them, and Andy Bannister of the London School of Theology. Do join us again in just a moment. Good afternoon and welcome back to the programme. Don't forget, plenty more to come on Premier this afternoon. Do stay tuned for Hip Rock UK following this programme at 4 o'clock. That's with Dave and Bea. We're going to be returning to our discussion on the historicity of the Gospels in just a moment, but let me tell you that next week at the same time on Unbelievable, we're going to be looking at Christian Universalism. This is an interesting one, more of a sort of debate within Christianity, I suppose, but there are a number of people who hold to the biblical truth of Christianity, but say salvation will be for everyone. Everyone will be saved through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's an interesting position. We're going to be hearing from a person who calls himself the Evangelical Universalist, Gregory MacDonald. He's written a book about his beliefs. We'll also be hearing from Eric Stetson of the Christian Universalist Association. And defending the traditional Christian belief on what it is to be saved and doctrines of heaven and hell and that sort of thing, Dan Strange will be joining us from Oak Hill Theological College. So do hope you can join with us for that one at the same time, 2:30 till 4 o'clock next week. That's what's happening next week. Now back to our discussion on the truth of the Gospels. And do hope you're finding this as fascinating as I am. We're here in the studio with Norman Hanson. He's a former Christian, now an atheist, and he's been telling us why he has serious problems with the truth of the Gospels, which claim to show what happened to Jesus. And we're also here with Andy Bannister of the London School of Theology.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So we were hearing from Andy just in that last section, Norman, and he was telling us, you know, the various reasons why he does believe that there's good reason for seeing Jesus and everything that the Gospels talk about as not being some kind of following some mould of how people would have presented a Messiah or that sort of thing. He's saying it goes against the grain in a way. It's that is a mark of its authenticity. But you have a problem with what some of the aspects he's bringing up there. Tell us what your concerns
well,
are.
Yes, I mean, movements very often spring off in sort of odd directions. So it isn't sort of uniqueness doesn't mean true. It might have a basis for saying, well, you know, it's unusual and therefore may mean that something significant happened, or it may just mean that this particular set of believers came to terms with their problem in a different way.
How can you be sure that the gospel writers were recording the accounts of eyewitnesses? What's your evidence for that, Andy?
I think there are a whole range of evidences you could point to, but let me give you just one example that would be an interesting one. Let's take one from the Richard Borkin book that I just mentioned. One of the bits of research that that Richard did. That's an absolutely fascinating study. Is he went through Jewish historical records from the first century and statistically analysed what Jewish names were popular at particular given times. And you can show how they change, the same as they change today. Certain names come into vogue, certain names fall out of popularity. And he was able to plot this from a period from about 200 years before Christ through into the sort of 300 and 400s and generate a sort of map of popularity of basically Jewish first names. He then takes the Gospels and says, well, how do the Gospels fit into this? Do they look like they fit the right period, or do they look like somebody writing later and redacting back who didn't have a clue what was going on? And actually, the Gospels, and this the interesting thing about his research, this was a sort of sideline from something else, he didn't set out to prove this, this was a sort of accidental discovery on the side, fit the map of first century Palestinian Jewish names perfectly. Now, that doesn't prove, because we're talking history here, and I think one of the important things with history is say you can never 100% prove with history. You can prove sort of to be certain, very certain, doubtful, and so on. But that's a very good marker that actually the traditions that are recorded for us in the Gospels come from people who lived and operated in the period, because that's the kind of incidental detail you or I couldn't make up. If I was writing a novel, say in the vein of say Sherlock Holmes, for example, you can guarantee I wouldn't get that detail right because I don't have a clue. What names were popular, what local detail was the case in Victorian London. So, for example, when we discover things like this in the Gospels, and that's just one of dozens of examples I could point to for what we would say as historians we would call incidental background detail, gives you a very good clue that at the very least the people who wrote at the time.
It's a really interesting little piece of evidence there. But for you, Norman, do you have a problem with the idea that these were eyewitness accounts that are being recorded?
Well, yes, I do. I think that at least two of the writers, and are not even claimed to be eyewitnesses. So you then have the idea that either Mark was taking dictation from Peter, or was writing down what Peter had said, and then sort of wrote it down later as he recalled it, sometime in the late 60s or 70s after Peter had been executed. So that makes Mark's gospel a bit later than Andy said or suggested. Yes, you have this problem of tying in their stories with what you would expect from an eyewitness, or at least from a recollection of an eyewitness. For instance, Mark's gospel makes certain gaffes, like confusing the high priest who was in charge of the temple or the tabernacle at the time of David with his father, or rather his son, and in the passage about sort of giving I think he says it's Abiathar, and it should be one of the others, another beginning with A, but sorry, my memory for names has just sort of come to the fore here and dropped out. But I mean, he also makes sort of gaffes about the sort of geography of the sort of northern Palestine. The
Galilean
area.
What you're suggesting is he was working from memory on this stuff. He wasn't,
he probably hadn't even been to first century Palestine. I mean, just getting the names right. I mean, taking Sherlock Holmes again, Conan Doyle is writing the Sherlock Holmes stories only a few years later than they're actually set. So to get the sort of balance of names right probably wasn't that difficult for Conan Doyle to have a sort of... credibility with Victoria London.
Yeah. I think I was going to say, we need to be careful with pushing the metaphor there.
The
example of the Sherlock Holmes was if I was writing 70 years after, I think there would be a problem. I think the other interesting thing with Mark, I mean, focusing on Mark being our earliest gospel, there would be two observations I would make. One, and this is an area of contention in scholarship, so I can't claim the majority of scholars on my side, but there's a good number. I would personally have no problem dating Mark and in fact the other Gospels before 70, because I think when you read the impact that the fall of Jerusalem had on first century Judaism, we cannot as 21st century post-Enlightenment Westerners have the slightest clue, I think, about the explosion that caused in first century Judaism. Their entire world, religiously, politically, socially, collapsed at that moment. And I personally do not see the echoes of that in something like Mark's accounts,
right?
When Jesus is prophesying the fall
so
of Jerusalem.
So for you, that's a good pointer to that's, it being yes, pre-fall of Jerusalem.
The other argument that's often made, and I think that you can make this case even more strongly, is someone like Luke. I mean, when Luke writes a two-volume work, he's writing, you know, he writes Luke, and then he goes on and writes the Acts of the Apostles as well. Particularly in Acts, I think, again, you would see some kind of echo of that, because he's writing into a Roman context, and to go, I think at some point it would have served... It would have served all the gospel writers, and this is the point those scholars I can call on my side would argue, that it would serve the gospel writers' purpose beautifully if Jerusalem had collapsed at that point, because it would be the ultimate apologetic to go, you know, the Jew, particularly John. I mean, John, who is accused of being anti-Jewish in places and talking about the kind of stiff-necked Jews who've rejected Jesus and not following him, the ability to go, aha, and look what happened in 70. Look at God's judgment on the temple and the previous institutions, all because you didn't follow the Messiah. The gospel writers are either very good historians and resist that urge, or they're actually writing on the events leading up to that moment.
Let's move on now to the issue of contradiction, because you've mentioned the gaffe that you claim that, that Mark makes in wrongly attributing a name to a high priest. I mean, and presumably you feel that there are other similar instances or contradictions between the Gospels as well, which make you wonder whether they really could have been writing from the same story if they're getting different accounts of things.
Well, no, I think it's more that sometimes they edit each other, or, you know, Luke and Matthew edit Mark on occasions. Only a handful, but you know, it's whether it's the Gadarene or the Gerasene swine, you know, that rush off the cliff, Gerasa is about 30 miles away from the Galilee, and Gadara is about 6 miles away. It's still quite a long run up for the swine to sort of take for the cliff. It's bits and pieces like this that sort of imply that they've fitted a story into a geography rather than having that geography already there. And that one of the things about the Gospels and about Acts is that there are not huge amounts of detail about what's going on around at the time. So you can't sort of tie it very precisely to individuals and so on. It's sort of like a historical novel. That's well written because you're familiar with the time. They filled in their around the history that they know. But I mean the birth of Christ. You know, the timing for that is perhaps the best example, where you either say he's in the time of Herod the Great, or he's in the time of Quirinius, the governor of Syria. But you can't have them both, because they just don't overlap, and
both are mentioned.
Yeah,
governors
of Syria during the time of Herod the Great, right, are well documented. So
yeah,
should we answer some of those?
Yeah, should we have a crack at that?
I mean, I think let's take a couple of the specifics and then make a couple of general comments. I think one of the first things I want to say about Luke and history is Luke particularly is a historian actually who you cannot accuse of not rooting history in history. If you go and read, it's a multi-volume work, and I forget that the editor has slipped me briefly from my mind, but you've got kind of Luke in his Greco-Roman context is a multi-volume series of works looking at basically just how good a source Luke is for the first century. In fact, Luke is used by secular historians as well as theologians, because he's a pretty good writer. To give you just one example, one of the terms that he uses for a minor Roman a political leader, and I forget which of his cities, was for a long time used as an example of Luke being not knowing what he was talking about, because we've got no other records of this particular Roman term being used for this particular civic position, until it turns up on a paving that was archaeologists sort of discovered about 100 years ago. So Luke actually is a good first century historian. So, I mean, and this raises another interesting question with the Gospels in general, a point that has been made, to return to the point no one made on the dating of the birth of Jesus, the issue around the census of under Quirinius, basically, and going, well, hang on, he was only, according to the external gospel sources we have, he was only governor of Syria for a certain point of time, Herod's at another point in time. Those seem to contradict. As one not particularly sympathetic, not evangelical historian pointed out, going, well, one possibility, which we can't actually prove, is that actually Quirinius was actually governor for two periods, and Luke is perfectly right. Luke is a valid first century source. We need to be careful about separating the Gospels off and putting them in one box and saying people like Tacitus and Josephus and other guys belong in another box. Luke is himself a perfectly valid source for the first century, even if something only appears in
Luke. I mean, are you saying that because we've got such a good testimony historically in the rest of Luke, that one apparently glaring error would seem odd?
Absolutely. And we do, and the interesting thing is, as historians, we do this all the time. There are plenty of places, and I won't bore people by listing them, where you take a historian like Josephus. Josephus, very important Jewish historian, wrote two major works. He wrote the Jewish War and his life, his own biography. He is our only source at times for vast amounts of what go on in first century and earlier Palestine. And there are times where you look at Josephus and go, That sounds a bit odd, or that's our only source for that, or that appears to contradict something else. And historians have in places said we have to give Josephus the benefit of the doubt. We can test him here, we can test him here, but on this particular issue, we can't. It might have happened that way, but we'll give him historically the benefit of the doubt, because at places where we can test him, we can show good credibility. Now, you can only push that so far. I wouldn't want to be, you know, using that argument to shore up everything the gospel writers say and appealing to sort of arguments from silence. But I would be saying, say, particularly on someone like Luke's account, who I think is such a careful historian and has set out deliberately to write a Roman-style history of Jesus, I think we need to give Luke the benefit of the doubt.
What about this thing?
My point is not that Luke is not writing. I mean, I'm quite prepared to sort of believe that pretty much all of the Gospels were written sometime at the end of the first century. You know, that they're not first century documents. It's or have first century origins. It's just that to say that somebody had the correct title for somebody is equivalent to saying, well, you know, like I was saying earlier, that you can sort of tie in Sherlock Holmes getting a train from Victoria to Norbury and saying, well, yes, you can get trains from Victoria to Norbury in Victorian times, but it doesn't necessarily mean that Sherlock Holmes actually caught the train.
No, absolutely.
And did that.
But it does. What's important, though, as I said, it does work the other way around. If I dug up if I was sort of busy digging out in the desert somewhere in Egypt, and I dug up a document purporting to give a history of Akhenaten, you know, sort of pharaoh who was there in 1500 BC, and it referred to him listening to Premier Radio and watching Chelsea play on a Saturday, I could probably go, I think this looks like a forgery. Or the other sort of joke in historical circles is to go, you know, if you're digging in a Roman site somewhere in the north of England and you dig up a coin stamped 100 BC, well, you know immediately you've got a fake. and the same goes here. In a sense, you're right in that you can't use this argument, only takes you so far, but it certainly does put paid, and I'm sure you won't, and I'm not accusing you of saying this, but it does put paid to some of your kind of sceptical friends who would want to sort of throw the Gospels completely out the window as historical sources. The Gospels are good historical sources. They tell us an awful lot about the first century Palestine, particularly that's been confirmed since the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1947.
What about this idea that Norman mentioned, that the gospel writers are editing each other? So one says the Gerasene swine, another sort of thinks, it must have happened in Gadara or something, or perhaps it was the other way around, I don't know. But you've got two different places that are mentioned, apparently.
I mean, in one sense, again, I really don't want to sound like an arch conservative just defending everything, because I'm sort of fairly flexible at times in my view of scripture, but I think on that one is a bad example. I wouldn't nail my sceptical flag to that one, because there have been a number of good sort of studies that have shown actually that potential problem is a confusion of geography in itself, in that in Roman times, when we've got documentary evidence of this, that actually, I forget which way around it is, one of them is the region and one is the town, in the same way that you have Greater London and you have London itself, that actually one was a sort of larger civic administrative area and one was the town itself. So actually both may be right. Where the editing comes in, and Norman's right that you have, you know, the writers editing each other, I have no problem with that, has been that one has chosen to use the other term, possibly because that's a term that had survived into the time they were writing. But both are actually correct on that particular issue. There are more difficult contradictory issues, but I shall let Norman raise those ones. That one is easily reconciled.
We're not going to have that much time for raising those sorts of issues. We might have to maybe
another show.
Leave it for another show. Though, having said that, we did do a big show once on gospel, well, potential differences and contradictions on you know, between accounts, etc. Indeed, I think just about last Easter you joined us for one on the you were contributing, I think, to one about inaccuracies or differences between the gospel accounts of the resurrection.
Okay,
yeah,
right.
And that sort of thing.
So we've covered the ground before.
It's been covered, but we can always cover it again at some point, and it's important to do that. I mean, well, moving on from these, you know, potential contradictions, etc. I did pose another question, a fundamental question. I don't know whether this is something which essentially might be a kind of fairly key to your own atheism and why you've rejected Christianity, Norman, which is if we can even have these kind of debates about whether it's true that there are arguments for and against. This is ultimately, if it's true, the most important truth in the world. Shouldn't we have a kind of absolutely watertight, infallible kind of document to give us that kind of evidence we need if this is really got the way God wants to communicate with human beings? I mean, is that the sort of view you would take, Norman?
It is. I'm a great fan of Bart Ehrman, who's was, like myself, an evangelical Christian, went to the Moody Bible Institute. Then went on, I forget to where, but, you know, every time he moved on to a new college, they would always say, oh, you know, that lot over there are a bit more liberal, you know, and than before. And eventually he sort of got to one college where he was doing, I think he's doing his PhD, and he looked at one of the this issue of which high priest Mark is referring to, you know, and this error. And his tutor just said, well, you know, maybe Mark made a mistake. And that set his chain of thinking that, well, you know, if these were the definitive truth about the Messiah, you know, somebody who was going to save the world from hell, don't you think God might have organized it so that not only the original versions were inspired, but that the hand down of those documents had a much better pedigree, and that you didn't have thousands of differences among the manuscripts. And okay, I agree that most of them are small, but there are more differences among the manuscripts that we have in our possession than there are words in the New Testament. So, you know, you can start to see the issues.
I mean, what the suggestion is that even though it may seem a small thing on the face of it, the name of a high priest,
yes,
ultimately, if you know, it's kind of those small things that if they're wrong, you kind of have to ask, well, doesn't that throw into question the whole document? If God if this is God's way of communicating stuff, let's get it all right.
You're making a huge claim to say that this has the ultimate truth about the universe, life and everything, and you need some fairly extraordinary evidence, and so far Andy hasn't produced any real evidence. I'm quite prepared to say they're historical documents. They were written back in the first century or early second century, maybe, for some of them, but that they are not, it doesn't prove what they're setting out to prove, that we you know,
We'll let Andy answer that, yeah, and then we'll have to draw things to a close.
I think I take those points in reverse order as I like to. I think it's very interesting that Norman used the words that the Gospels don't prove what they set out to prove. I wouldn't personally say the Gospels are setting out necessarily to prove, in the sense of the word prove there, you know, that the claims about Jesus are true in the sense that Norman is asking. The Gospels do a different job. The Gospels really are set out to capture in writing what it is, the stories and the traditions and the history that defined the early Christian community, because the eyewitnesses were dying out, and so all traditions have been committed to writing. They're not set out to perform the function of a modern apologetic. There are good tools to do that, and we can do that using them, but that's not primarily, I would argue, why they wrote. So we need to remember that very carefully before we start throwing brickbats at them. Another couple of points on textual criticism, if I may, very quickly. The idea that this figure that they're being more variant readings in the textual history than there are words in the Gospels is quite, I try to have hard to suppress a laugh at that one. It's a very old atheistic canard, and going, the only way you get that figure is by if 400 manuscripts misspell the same word, then you tot up 400 variants on your list. And what's interesting, Bart Ehrman's a really interesting case in point, because he's often misused, his old Bart. He is no evangelical, of course he's not, and I wouldn't even pretend to claim otherwise, but he set out in his book to argue the Orthodox corruption of Scripture, he titled it, and he set up to prove that the Orthodox Church over the years, Orthodox with a capital O, so to the Orthodox Christian tradition, had made changes upon changes upon changes for theological reasons to the text, for a whole series of good reasons, but it had been changed. But his key conclusion was, you can get behind that, because the textual tradition is so good, we can get back to and be assured of what the text originally said with a huge degree of certainty. And the figure that most textual critics would fling around would be something like 99.95% certainty of what the original Greek manuscripts of the New Testament said, because so good has the preservation of the manuscript tradition been.
Do you feel that that's enough to say God can use this to show his purposes? And
I think so. And I think an interesting thought experiment is to go on the kind of, well, could God have done it better, which is effectively what we're asking, is where would God's job end if God had given us, you know, Gospels that look different, I guess is what maybe Norman's saying, that proved it better, and then if the textual tradition was better. But then, of course, as the reader on the end of it, one of the great things that the 20th and 21st century in literary criticism have shown us is that a large part of the interpretation of a text is down to the reader. So as well as preserving doing the Gospels differently, preserving the tradition differently, God has got to interfere cognitively with you or I as we read the text, and so on and so forth. Where does God's job actually stop? In terms of controlling the whole set of it, if you're not careful, you actually end up with something that a lot of atheists end up with by a different route, by a scientific route. You end up with determinism. There is no freedom at all, because God has tinkered with the whole thing through the whole process in order to get the outcome that he wants. I personally think the Gospels and the New Testament generally are a fantastic resource for faith, for a number of reasons which we haven't got time to go into, but one of them is because of the sheer variety of writings in them. We haven't touched on, for example, the letters of Paul. The fact we have letters and writings of that sort preserved in the New Testament and preserved so early is a fantastic resource for the historian, because not only can we see in the Gospels what the stories were that the first Christians were telling about Jesus, and we can weigh them historically, we can get behind even those, because Paul's writings are even earlier, the early 40s, and go, what were the debates, what were the discussions, what was the theology going on in the early church? And we can marry those two together, and that gives us some really interesting insights.
It's been a fascinating discussion. It's been all, you know, it goes all too quickly. So many more things that could be said, and I'm sure, you know, both of you had more points that you would have liked to have brought to the table, but we'll have to leave it there for the moment. And let me remind you, if you're listening and you'd like to get in touch, you can send me your comments by phone and by email. 08456 52 52 52, select option 5, or email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. My thanks again to my guest Norman Hanson, our atheist on the programme this afternoon, and Andy Bannister of the London School of Theology. Well, let's find out what's coming up on the programme next week. You're unbelievable. We're looking at Christian Universalism. These are Christians who say everybody's going to heaven in the end. That, of course, contradicts Orthodox Christian teaching, but we'll find out why some evangelicals are saying that these days, why they believe the Bible says that. That's on the programme next week. We'll also have Dan Strange with us, defending Orthodox Christian doctrine on this front. So do join us for that programme on Christian Universalism. That's at the same time, between 2:30 and 4 o'clock next week. And do check out the webpage if you want to listen back, or send on to a friend, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. See you next week.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.